Hello everyone and welcome to this online session on FSCom's 2023 FinCrime Compliance Report. My name is Niamh McConaughey and I'm the Marketing Executive at FSCom, and I'm delighted to introduce the Manager in the FinCrime team, Richard Dunlop. Just before I pass you over to Richard, I need to make you aware of some housekeeping. So the audience is on mute and you will only be able to hear Richard and myself throughout the session. If you have any questions, please post them into the question box on the side panel, and we will try and get through as many as we can in the Q&A session at the end. Any questions not answered will be followed up by email next week. Finally, we always get asked if this session is recorded, and yes, it is. You will receive the recording in a follow-up email, and it will also be available on the FSCom website in the next few days. So that's all from me for now, and over to you, Richard, for the presentation.
Thanks, Niamh. Good afternoon, everyone. And as Niamh said, welcome to this webinar, which is focused on our FinCrime compliance report for 2023. And I'll get into a bit more about what that is as we move through. So first of all, the contents of today's session will be to talk about the purpose and scope of the FinCrime compliance report. To do that properly, we'll go into an overview of how we do conduct AML compliance audits at FSCom, and some of you may be aware of that and been through them yourselves, some of you won't. We'll look at the audit review and testing areas that we go through during our audit process, and that of course sets the scene for where we may have findings and recommendations, and that's where the statistics of this FinCrime compliance report are focused on. We will dive into that statistical overview, which compares this year's results, but also against our 2022 report. And then we'll look into the top five most affected areas, because there are 14 testing areas, as you'll see. I'm going to deep dive into some of the key findings across those five most affected areas, so there'll be a bit more detail as to what the key issues are within each finding. And then we'll just look at some of the other key findings across some of the other areas that we do test. And then at the end of the session, there will be some time for Q&A. But first of all, a bit of an introduction into FSCom. So FSCom is a governance, risk and compliance consultancy firm. We were established in 2011 and we are officially headquartered in Belfast, but we do have offices also in London and Dublin. We've got experience of assisting firms adhere to the regulatory requirements, specifically in the UK and Ireland. But as you'll see from this report, we do also work with firms who are regulated and authorised in other jurisdictions. We're a highly skilled team of deep domain compliance experts, and we've advised in hundreds of projects, including authorisations, audits, which of course AML, but we also do safeguarding and IT and CAS audits, interpretation advice and opinions, and we do also do training and interim roles. We've won numerous awards for our work with our clients in providing advisory and project-based work across core practice areas of payments, investments, financial crime prevention, and IT risk assurance. A brief introduction to myself. I'm Richard Dunlop. I'm a manager here at FSCom, and I've worked extensively with the financial crime team, but also with the payments team. My experience has gone through, like I said, leading those financial crime audits for major payment, e-money and crypto asset institutions. As part of my payments team experience, I've worked on safeguarding audits for e-money and payment institutions. I've also spent 6 months on an interim role for a major crypto asset firm. The majority of my responsibilities were to approve and review institutional client applications, reviewing and filing SARs, but also developing policies and procedures and delivering some training. More recently, I'm working in the authorizations field, working on EMI, API and MiFID applications, as well as VASP registrations with the FCA. I have led CDD remediation project for a major FX firm, as well as worked on numerous others. And day to day, we would draft a lot of AML procedural documentation, as well as policies, risk assessments, etc. So the FinCrime compliance report, what is it and what's the purpose of it? Well, obviously, at FSCom, we do conduct a lot of AML compliance audits. And in fact, this year, or across the July 2022 to June 2023, we conducted 60, conducted and finalized 60. And this report seeks to analyze the data that comes out of all of those together to look at what the key issues are that firms are facing, but also just to give firms who've undertaken an audit with us an idea of where they kind of sit within the industry and how many findings kind of looks about average across all of these 60 firms. As I mentioned at the start, the majority of those audits are UK based. However, these reviews in particular have also been conducted in Ireland, Switzerland, Jersey, Singapore, Lithuania, as well as the Cayman Islands. And each time an audit's conducted, it is done to that regulatory standard and guidance. Also, they're not just across one type of financial service firm, but we haven't, in fact, done these over EMIs, APIs, VASPs, as well as MSBs. So to get into an overview of the process, so the audit process at FSCom consists of four key elements. The initial first step is to gather as much AML and CTF policy and procedural documentation from the firm that we're auditing. It means that when we move into the testing phase and the side-by-side walkthroughs, as well as the interviews, we're aware of what the framework should look like. We're also aware a little bit more of the business model, who the firm is, what they do, their types of customers. And it gives us a sense of the line of questioning we might go down as well, because effectively the policies hopefully reflect what's happening on site. So if we see any kind of gaps in the policy, we might ask about that. And sometimes we get answers. But that's where the first step is. We then go into the side-by-side walkthroughs. So this is where we break the process down into 13 to 14 different elements, and we make sure we have a session for each. So that goes through the customer journey, so the CDD onboarding, customer risk assessment, EDD. We look at the sign-off. We then go on to look at ongoing monitoring, et cetera. And we spend time with the right people in the team of the client firm to make sure that they're talking us through and also sharing their screen if it's off-site or when it's on-site, you know, taking us through the process as best they can. We ask questions and we deliberate with them on some of the points. We also do some testing. The testing we can do in many different areas, but the primary focus here is that we'll look at CDD files. So we'll get a sample size of your customer files, whether it's retail, institutional, a mix of the two. And we'll go through them to see that they are in fact up to date and they're reflective of both your regulatory obligations, but also internal procedures at the firm for what you need to collect and hold on your different clients. We'll also look at screening. So we have a screening test where we'll send you a number of names of PEPs or of sanctioned entities or persons, and we'll ask you to run that through your various screening providers and see the output of that. We also do test your transaction alerts to see how they've been functioning and whether the alerts are being actioned appropriately in time with your internal SLAs, whether your escalation process is being monitored accordingly. And we will also look at some of your internal and external SARs just to see that everything maps back to a robust escalation and reporting procedure. The staff interviews, this is something where we do one-on-one interviews or hopefully more informal chats with the wider team. We're conscious that we spend a lot of time with compliance during the process. So we do also talk to compliance in the interviews, but we'll talk to some of the more senior management, some of the board level. We'll also talk to the frontline, we'll talk to the sales team, and it really gauges the kind of gives us a flavor of the culture of compliance within the firm. So the output of that process is obviously a report, which is initially issued in draft form, and then we do accept challenge at that point, of course, but we'll be communicating throughout the process as to what we think, you know, might show up on the report in terms of findings and recommendations. Findings are always issued under a high impact or low impact, and that scoring is done on two factors. The first is the level of compliance, and this is scored as significantly non-compliant. So with the regulations, we see a gap in that process. partially non-compliant where potentially you've not hit all of your regulatory obligations, compliant with improvements, which you could argue is a best practice recommendation because the process is effectively compliant, however it could be done better or it could be enhanced, and then the fourth level is that the process is fully compliant. The impact then to the firm. So while the level of compliance is quite a static across the board, no matter the size of the firm, the impact, I think it can be subject to interpretation and based on the type of firm and the size of the firm. Also, you know, I guess a transaction monitoring backlog, the size of that can be dependent on a lot of things, how many transactions are actually going through, what does the resource capacity look like, etc. So the impact is something that changes, and that's scored on a 1 to 5 basis. So what are those audit, review and testing areas? Well, we would go through 14 of these, and they are as follows. This is in no particular order, but we would go through SARS, we'd go through the process there. AML training, we'd look at, you know, how that's being done across the firm, but also, you know, to the compliance team, to the board, and to role specific training. Agent and or distributor monitoring. So this isn't applicable to all firms, but it will be applicable to those firms who do service agents or distributors. And effectively what we mean here is these types of clients who have their own underlying customers. So they're effectively using some form of our license to be able to provide services to their own customers. So we would expect there to be some form of monitoring there. Customer risk assessment, how do you risk rate your customers? What's the process behind that? And obviously institutional, retail, there might be a couple of different moving parts here. Whole firm risk assessment, here we're talking about your specifically AML, CTF, proliferation financing, and again, across different categories called out by the regulator. Customer due diligence, we look at this from two viewpoints. The first being, how is your policy holding you to that standard, and does it match what you need to do? But also that file testing element. So have you actually put into practice what your policy says you do? And so that kind of comes out in the wash during that file testing. Enhanced due diligence, again, probably like CDD, this is both. We will look at how this is maintained in policy, but we will look to select some of your higher risk clients in that CDD file testing element. And of course, we would have expected them to have gone through some form of EDD. And so we'll be checking that's been done, and then any reviews after that have been managed as well. Periodic and event-driven reviews. So we'll look at that periodic process for looking at your clients, whether that's on an annual basis or whatever it may be. We'll look at who's doing that, how it's maintained, etc. Event-driven reviews, anything else that can happen during the life cycle where you're looking at your clients. Transaction monitoring, obviously we'll look at the tools and systems you use and how the alerts are done. And the screening, something similar, so we'll go through that process also. With regards to compliance monitoring, we're looking at any second line testing and review that's been implemented, and again, how that's managed and maintained and who the relevant people are. We'll look at your MLRO reporting. So in the UK, an annual obligation to do that, as well as your management information escalation to senior management or board. And the AML policies and procedures goes on throughout, but of course, we'll have looked at that initially pre-audit. So at this point, I'm just going to pass over to Niamh for our poll.
Yes, thank you, Richard. I'm going to launch the poll now. So if everyone could please take part and engage. So what is the most effective review and testing area across the 60 AML audits? Is that compliance monitoring, consumer risk assessment, transaction monitoring, CDD file testing, which is customer due diligence, or EDD, which is enhanced due diligence. So if everyone could take part and just if that and take your vote, please. And then I will read that out again. So what is the most affected review and testing area across the 60 AML audits? Is it compliance monitoring, customer risk assessment, transaction monitoring, CDD file testing, which is customer due diligence, or EDD, which is enhanced due diligence. Okay, that's perfect. So over 50% has voted. So I'm going to close the poll and release the results. Share. So coming up the top is CDD file testing at 32%. After that, it is compliance monitoring at 24%. And then transaction monitoring at 18%. And customer risk assessment at 12%. And EDD at 15%. So I will close this now. So Richard, what do you how do you find that result?
Yeah, well, we're going to see, obviously, Niamh, as we move through the next couple of slides. But yeah, I suppose the CDD file testing is certainly something that always comes up. You know, it's there's so many different nuances to it, especially with the kind of corporate clients, whereby processes are uplifted or you've got so many different people doing the testing and maintaining files across different systems. So, of course, that is an area where we generally do see quite a few gaps.
Perfect. Thank you, Richard. I'm going to go now and you carry on.
Thank you. Perfect. Okay, so moving on to the next slide, and then we will see the result of that poll. But here's a statistical overview. I'm not too sure how many of you will have seen our 2022 report, which focused on very similar areas. In that report, we looked at 57 AML compliance audits and we found 295 findings, 198 of those to be low and 97 of those to be high impact. And that gave us our averages in the brackets there on the right hand side. So approximately just over 5 findings per audit, approximately 3.5 of those low impact and approximately 1.7 high impact. So we did do 3 more audits across the 2023 report. And we actually found slightly fewer findings, which I suppose is positive, albeit that it's relatively similar, and an average of 4.76 per audit. So again, this is what I talked about at the start, where we can kind of start to benchmark where we may be as a firm. 198 low impact findings, so exactly the same number, but slightly different on the average, and 88 high impact findings. So here are the top 5 most affected areas. Compliance monitoring, which I believe came in at 2nd in the poll, is actually top with 40 findings across those reports. Customer risk assessment 2nd, transaction monitoring, CDD file testing does come in at 4th, and EDD comes in after that. Of course, as we see it, that EDD can also be influenced and may possibly part of that CDD file testing. So I think we're not too far off the mark. So let's deep dive a little more into what those key findings were across those 5 most affected areas. Compliance monitoring, we start with the top one. So I think the 3rd one down there is potentially the best place to start, that no compliance monitoring plan's actually been developed. So we would just, of course, consider that to be a gap and against what the expectation of the regulator is. So just to set out what a compliance monitoring plan should be, is that effectively the 2nd line should have oversight of how the policies, procedures, controls, etc., everything that's put forward and done by the 1st line. We need to ensure that those controls are working effectively. And so we would tend to monitor then, you know, anything and everything, kind of like an audit, I suppose, but from a 2nd line perspective. So going in to look at your CDD files, maybe dip sampling every so often, periodically, monthly, quarterly, to check maybe 5% of your files or newly onboarded, whatever that number may be, to look at have the systems been functioning correctly, have the processes been followed appropriately. So you might look at, again, a number of transaction monitoring alerts, you might look at a number of screening alerts, you might test your screening provider like we do, putting some names through it and checking that they hit. You'll look at your training, has everyone gone through that or is it at least on track? So that's what the expectation is, and often we've found that no actual plan has been developed. The 1st one there, a plan has been developed, but it's not adequate for the size and nature of the firm. So this might be something that falls under a partially non-compliant or even compliant with improvements, whereby there is a framework in place. However, it doesn't go into the detail that potentially this type of firm requires, and that could be because the firm is scaling and these controls are obviously being used by a lot more people, and therefore they need to be tested more often to ensure that when new staff come on and they're now allowed to kind of carry out those frontline operations, are we sure that they're all being done appropriately? Also, maybe we want to reduce how often we do those control testing because we're starting to grow even further, or just because we've noticed in a whole firm risk assessment that that particular control is not as robust as it could be. We then maybe want to look at it more often until we're comfortable that it is functioning correctly. So I think we deep dive into exactly how the plan's been developed and do we consider it to be an adequate plan for that firm. The second one, the CMP requires enhancing because it does not mandate specific testing across the entirety of the firm's anti-financial crime controls. So we understand potentially when a new firm is a startup, obviously they're going to have to decide how to split their resource, and maybe that starts off with just looking at the big ticket items, so to speak, maybe your CDD, moving into transaction monitoring and screening. However, obviously, again, based on the size and nature of the firm and how long they've been operational, we would expect that at some point the entirety of your controls are tested and put through that compliance monitoring plan, so that to ensure that the second line does actually have oversight of what's going on. With regards to customer risk assessment, this was something that came up in last year's report also, and links to EDD in many ways. So we found that EDD findings and customer risk assessment can be interlinked, of course, and the first bit here and the second bit really is to do with countries. So often within a holistic customer risk assessment, a firm will implement a country risk assessment, which will monitor different things. It will look at risk across where a customer or entity is actually based or incorporated for an entity. Again, for an entity where the UBOs may be based, you might look at citizenship for an individual or for a UBO or director, but country risk comes into that. Now, the MLRs would state that any affiliation with a high-risk third country customer or a transaction must go through prescriptive EDD. So the first one here is not that the EDD hasn't been done, but actually that the methodology within the risk assessment holistically fails to ensure that EDD would actually be performed. The majority of firms will conduct EDD when a customer's risk rated as high. Not always. There might be triggers to make sure that that doesn't happen. There may also be manual review which uplifts them. So we do look into all of that, but we've seen on this occasion that actually there's no assurance that when a high-risk third country was identified that would go through that EDD process on all occasions. This is obviously much more difficult to manage as a firm scales. So if there is a manual element to ensuring that EDD, as you scale, that you can start to miss that. So we would say that like a PEP, there should be something in there to make sure there's a fail-safe to say, right, we've got a high-risk country, a high-risk third country noted here, and they need to go through this process. The second one is linked to that, but also, I suppose, linked to the point of compliance monitoring, in that the country risk assessment hasn't been updated to include relevant regulatory changes. The UK fundamentally follows FATF in terms of their country risk assessment ratings, or their high-risk third countries, but different updates are made across the year or across different periods of time, and often horizon scanning, kind of ad hoc horizon scanning, should capture that. But if it doesn't, we would recommend that within your compliance monitoring plan, there is a kind of, again, a periodic look at high-risk third countries or even other statistics that you want to look at, you know your country, Basel, Transparency International, whatever you look at. And so you may want to go back and look at all them and make sure your country risk assessment's up to date. The third one, the scoring methodology within the risk assessment does not guarantee consistent risk scoring of customers. This can often be that there's that manual element to it, or more subjective rather than objective. And again, I think with the smaller firms, this can be fine. I think as soon as you do start to scale, I think having that more automated risk assessment, which will consistently risk rate your customers against a number of factors that have been chosen, because there's a reason those factors have been chosen. It brings about, especially to an auditor anyway, we can see the methodology behind why someone's been risk rated as low, medium or high. Anytime there is that decision from a senior person, perhaps the MLRO, to reduce someone's risk or increase someone's risk, I think always making sure that's noted and documented with the audit trail is really important. But as a firm scales, we do think from a first instance, there should be an automated process. And then if there wants to be some kind of manual intervention, that can come with the senior team or the second line. And again, like I said, note that and document it. So moving on to the third most affected area, which is transaction monitoring. So there's a number of different key findings within this. The first one being that we would consider that the TM rules are insufficient. And here's that phrase again, which we'll see a good bit, based on the size and nature of the firm, and as well as their customer base and product offering. So many firms now are obviously using these third party tools and systems to implement a transaction monitoring program. They sometimes come, or most of the time come, with a kind of off the shelf set of rules, which can be useful. However, they're very unlikely to be applicable wholly to your firm, to your customer base, to the products you offer. And we would expect that they've gone through a good degree of amendment and upheaval to ensure that they're appropriate for what you do and who you are. And thereafter, they should also be subject to review and even testing if we can, to ensure that the number of false positives is not alarmingly high or low, and that we are actually getting data that we can use. And hopefully, you know, this is also a customer driven exercise, in that we don't just want to stop all transactions. We want to ensure that what we're subjecting to review is generally requiring a review. So insufficient is generally based on our testing of your transaction monitoring, looking at statistics and data, but also just knowledge of the industries. If we are offering to institutions or we're offering to retail, we know that those rules should obviously be different and will look different. The firm's TM process is only manual in nature, and their alerts are only subject to review retrospectively. So this is something which wouldn't be called out in the regulations. However, again, I think if you are processing huge amounts of transactions, or at least it's starting to grow, then doing it manually, I think anyone would realize, is not sustainable. And subjecting them only to a review retrospectively, again, not called out per se, but I think we would all be in agreement that there are higher risk transactions which we prefer to be able to review prior to that payment or transfer being processed or sent out. And so this again comes with it potentially a compliant with improvements, or potentially a partially non-compliant rather than, you know, a gap. However, this is based on how we feel the transaction monitoring program runs across the whole firm. The third one is fairly standard, in that the firm has a significant backlog of unactioned transaction monitoring alerts. The impact of this finding is obviously subject to change. It's subject to what the backlog actually looks like, but also how many staff are working that backlog and how many transaction alerts are coming in on a daily basis. So we can kind of start to realize what that backlog might look like in a week or in a month if the resource levels don't change, or if the transaction monitoring alerts don't drop. So that has a big impact on where we position that finding, but I suppose the word significant there suggests that finding in particular, you know, we would have considered that backlog to be something of note. So the fourth testing area is CDD. So here's where we considered that key CDD information was found to be missing or had not been sufficiently scrutinized. And here we talked about source of funds and source of wealth. So obviously, when I talk about missing, I think that's fairly clear what we mean. When we're talking about not being sufficiently scrutinized, I think that's something else to be really considered. You know, when we do require source of funds information or even source of wealth information, it's always worth understanding why and not making it tick box compliance. There's a reason we ask for those things, and that is to mitigate certain risks that our customers are obviously, or not obviously, but potentially putting us out to maybe inflict damage on our business if we don't understand these certain things. So source of funds, you know, let's say that's a bank statement or something, or it's 3 months of bank statements, and that tells us where the funds have come from, or a sale of a property. We need to scrutinize that as well. Does it match kind of the activity that the client wants to do on our platform or through our kind of services? Source of wealth, again, we should have an expectation of what this should be based on the person, based on their position. And so does what we're collecting online or gathering from the customer, does it start to tell a story of who the customer is and what they should be? So there is a big difference there between something that's missing and something that's not been sufficiently scrutinized. And that's where the CDD file, we'd be expecting it to be able to tell us that story, you know, right the way through from here's what we onboarded them and expected, and they've done this, these transactions, and here's why we're comfortable with them. So the second one, no evidence of a high-risk client being signed off by senior management. And here we actually have said as required by prescriptive EDD measures set out in the regulations. And purely from a UK perspective, for a lot of this here, we'll be talking about, you know, when we have a PEP or when we have a relationship with a high-risk third country. So that is required then to get that senior management sign off. And typically we would see that going through the MLRO as the senior person with the experience to ensure that they're comfortable. It may even go further to a risk committee. Generally, an internal process anyway is for high risk clients who aren't, you know, PEPs or high risk third country clients to go through some form of more senior sign off. And often we would say that that would be an MLRO. And I think firms would need to justify that why that wasn't. So there may also be a gap there. Like if it is their internal process to subject those clients to high risk sign off, we would also see that as an issue if we didn't find it in the file. But here we are talking purely about that prescriptive need. The last one, no evidence of screening having been carried out for a corporate entity or the individuals. So again, we're saying no evidence here. We're not saying it hasn't been done, but of course, when we come in to review a CDD file, it really is fairly black and white. You know, what do we ask for of the firm and what does the firm provide to us for our review? So we would always suggest that however your screening provider can get you back that evidence, whether it's a report, whether it's marking on the CRM, but something that creates a paper trail, an audit trail for us, or a regulator, obviously, to see that that's been done, because of course we don't want our good work to go unnoticed. If we do, as part of our process, go into kind of adverse media searches, and we're using kind of a Boolean string search on Google, let's save down that evidence and put it into a CDD file, because again, if that's part of our internal procedure, it's something that we need to evidence that we've done, and also because we just should show good practice, but also we may need to look back at that if we get a transaction monitoring alert. These are the bits we look back to the CDD file, and potentially it can tell us something that we didn't know previously. So EDD was the fifth most affected area. And again, I think in point two, we can already see that acronym HR3C, which is high risk third country. So there is a bit of crossover here. But obviously where it becomes an EDD finding rather than a customer risk assessment finding is where the actual issue has now moved into the process or into the file testing. So let's focus on that second one first. So the firm does not apply all the prescribed EDD measures to customers and or transactions with an affiliation with a high-risk third country. So again, a lot of firms' policies would always consider PEPs, and obviously the regulations, particularly in the UK, have measures which need to be taken or undertaken when dealing with a PEP. And generally, that's always pretty well documented in policy. But one that's often missed is they also have something similar for your high-risk third countries, and that will include the likes of source of funds and source of wealth information and scrutiny, as well as that senior management sign-off. So if the firm's not applying it in their policy, then it's highly unlikely they're going to collect it in their file testing. So that's a knock-on effect as well, and obviously a finding there. Customers being permitted to transact prior to EDD measures being applied as per the regulations and or the firm's policies. So again, EDD is a control that we put in place because we have found something in our customer that we consider to be a slightly higher risk in nature, for whatever reason that may be. And therefore, the collection of that information or the scrutiny of it should be conducted prior to allowing them to carry out services which we're offering, especially when we're talking about the PEPs and the high-risk third countries here, and that needs to happen at the establishment of the relationship. We've also found that within policy, the firm's EDD measures can be too high level or are insufficient, again, based on the size and nature of the firm. So I think there's a big thing in policy to suggest there's a lot of things for EDD that we may do, that we might do. And I think that's okay, because it gives us that kind of wider scope to be able to tackle specific bespoke risks that are presented to us by different types of clients. However, I do think there should always be a number of, I suppose, more compulsory EDD measures, and they don't have to be for the entire client base. But you might say, look, if we're dealing with jurisdictional risk, there's a couple of things we would like to see every time. Or if we're dealing with a customer who is a PEP, we'd like, well, obviously there you're prescribed to do certain things. But if you're dealing with a complex ownership structure, let's say, there are things that will make you more comfortable if you collect that information or documentation. So we would see it that, and it also makes it easier for the analysts who are doing, you know, the EDD or even the people signing it off, because we're aware that we need to get a few things, and that should satisfy us to a certain extent. The add-ons, the mays, the mites, I think those are in addition to this, in my opinion, because I think that's where we say, right, okay, we've got what would standardly make us comfortable with this client. We're potentially not quite there yet, and this is what we're going to go after, and our policy says that we will do that. I just think it's about being a bit more clear on exactly how to mitigate certain risks, rather than just being a little bit high level. And again, as the firm scales and there are more people who are doing the EDD, or, you know, and the MLRO potentially is the one creating what EDD is on a client by client basis, that almost becomes unscalable. So I think a few measures in there just to say, here's the risk, here's how we mitigate, and if we need to do anything further, then we will. So other key findings. So these are across the nine other areas which we test. And again, we are going to issue the report, which actually goes into every review and testing area in a lot of detail. Obviously, for the sake of an hour's webinar, we can't do that. But we do have some of the other kind of highlights from some of the other areas, and here they are. So the first one is that the detail within the firm's whole firm risk assessment, we wouldn't have considered it to be granular enough, based again on the size and nature of the firm. Now, why is this important? So, well, first of all, when we say granular enough, I suppose there's a few different elements to that. The first is starting with the identification of risk. How has that been done? Have we considered all of our risks? And potentially this is a growing document, and that might be the argument from a firm. However, before you set out your AML framework, you need to know what your risks are. You need to know then how to control them. So obviously, in the UK, they'll tell us to consider that across, you know, customer, jurisdiction, transactions, delivery channels, and our products and services. So we should look into, okay, what are all the products we offer, and have we identified all of the risks that they potentially expose us to? As we move through the assessment, then how are those risks inherently rated? So is that based on data? Is it more at the start, obviously just using our knowledge of the industry and prior experience or et cetera, but I think getting that down to show an independent reader, how we have done that, and it's not just a finger in the air, I suppose. Looking at the controls then, how have they been listed out? Have we considered all of them? How have they been assessed? So what data, again, do we have to suggest that this control is, I don't know, is very robust or not enough? Or so again, how do we assess those controls? Again, this might lead back in the future to our compliance monitoring plan, where we actually have evidence of testing controls and the output of that. So how does that then move into a residual risk rating? The residual risk rating is obviously affected by the controls and should hopefully reduce our inherent rating. And then thereafter, does it all link back to a risk appetite? Because if we've got a risk rating that maybe sits outside our risk appetite, are we now treating that risk, or are we considering that we need to do something here to either improve the control or reduce our exposure to that risk in some other way? So I think there's that granularity from moving through the whole assessment to ensure that it's a clear and concise document, and it almost acts as the cornerstone of our whole framework. The second one, a little more simple. This is a kind of test in isolation that I've talked about a few times, where we are running some PEP names and sanction names through the tool. And generally, this is just where there's a fail to generate an alert. That can be for a number of reasons. And we would always suggest that the firm check with their screening provider, if they are using one, as to how and why that's happened. But again, goes back to compliance monitoring. If we are testing our screening tool on a kind of monthly or quarterly basis, whatever we consider to be appropriate, then we should really be picking this up for an auditor. Now, of course, there's just times where an auditor fires in a name and it happens to not hit, and there might be a reason for that. Now, we're talking PEP names here, but we could also be talking sanction names, because we do test that also. And we all know what's been kind of the landscape's been with Russia and Ukraine and names being constantly added. I mean, I don't know how aware we all are of how quickly our different various providers actually update their lists. I don't know if we all know what our fuzzy logic settings are at and when they were last tested, but of course these all play a part in names not generating an alert. And of course this can lead to us servicing clients who are outside our risk appetite. No MLRO report has been formally presented to the board within the last year. So again, in the UK, this is an annual requirement. And of course the finding kind of speaks for itself. In that calendar year that there hadn't been a report presented. What does the report do? Well, the report is the MLRO's, it's their time, I suppose, to speak directly to the board in a formal manner. You do have smaller firms where the MLRO has constant communications with the board, larger firms where they maybe don't, but they have line, you know, they have ways to get information to the top. So we're always mindful of that type of scenarios. However, this is a formal report which can set out exactly what you want it to. And there's guidance out there for what an MLRO report should look like. But typically, I think a snapshot of the year, of where we are, of any issues we've had. Obviously, if an audit's been undertaken previously or recently, what were the findings? How are we tracking through that we're trying to remediate those findings? What's the progress of that? We should look at our training, you know, how are the staff trending? Are we up to date? So I think to give the board that higher level overview, but hopefully a detailed insight, more detailed insight into what the state of the AML framework looks like. It should also, of course, provide the roadmap for the year after, and potentially suggest to the board where there need to be improvements, potentially more resource, more funding, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a good chance to kind of get that all off your shoulders. And the last one here, it's only applicable to that, I think it was the third review and testing area we talked about, which was the agent and or distributor monitoring. So this is where we found there to be an inadequate level of oversight and or monitoring of the firm's agents and partners, as well as their underlying customers. So I suppose, what's the expectation here? Well, the expectation here is that there's an increased risk that we are removed from who is the ultimate customer who's using our services or using us through somebody else. So when the agent or distributor comes on board, we should have enhanced onboarding measures, KYC measures, in terms of potentially looking at their AML framework and seeing how they do things themselves. And if we are essentially kind of outsourcing, you know, the fact that they can do our their onboarding of the customers, transaction monitoring, we need to hold the pen. So while they can do that for us, we can absolutely not outsource that responsibility. That is all on us. And so the only way to maintain that is to ensure that we monitor them on an ongoing basis. And there's ways to do that. There can be the collection of management information, MI. So we might require from our agents or distributors that they present that to us monthly or whatever we decide to be appropriate. That might tell us things like how many customers are they actually onboarding? How are they using the products? How many SARs are they filing? How many alerts in terms of transactions or screening are actually going through them? It gives us an overview of, are they kind of acting as we would expect them to? Do their services seem to be being provided to a riskier client base than we expected? And we might take that further by doing, in addition to a periodic review, we might also require that they go through an audit, and whether that's through us or through an external, we might wish to see their external audit report. And that gives us that kind of assurance that what they're doing is correct, and that we can then rely on them going forward. So now's the question and answer part of the webinar. So Niamh, I'll put it back across to you to see what questions, if any, have come in.
Yeah, that's no worries. And there are a couple of questions have come through. So the first question is, what AML policies and or procedures do you expect firms to submit prior to the audit commencing?
Yeah, it's a good question. We do actually have a document, a pre-audit document request list here at FSCOM, and it does run us through, I suppose, everything is really what we would suggest, you know, and obviously that's different for different firms. So if I were to break it down by what's the most important, we would obviously expect an overarching AML CTF policy. That should explain to us a lot about the framework. We would expect to see any procedure documents or that kind of need to talk to that. So transaction monitoring, screening, SARs, if that's not contained in detail in the AML policy, then we would expect to see those procedure or policy documents off the back of it. We would also, for the sake of the sessions where we do talk about compliance monitoring, whole firm risk assessment, it's great for us to be able to see that beforehand, because it definitely leads the line of questioning. You know, if a firm doesn't have one, or if they've got something which is potentially confusing to us as an independent reader, but also maybe they've got it saved across different policies, it's good to know beforehand. So AML policy, AML whole firm risk assessment, compliance monitoring plan. And we'll also look to, for the client list, your organizational structure chart, because they help us with our testing and also our one-on-one interviews. And we will look to get a number of transaction monitoring alerts. Again, some firms find it difficult to get us that because of the way that data has to be extracted. And of course, we're always flexible, and that's not necessary. So I would probably say at a high level, Niamh, it would be the AML policy, the compliance monitoring plan, the whole firm risk assessment.
Perfect. Thank you. So the second question is, what is the purpose of the one-on-one interviews, and why do you typically who do you typically talk to?
Yeah, so I touched on it briefly. The purpose is really to understand that there is I suppose the culture of compliance in the firm is, culture of compliance is a great term that we use a lot, but it does help. We obviously spend the majority of the sessions, potentially sometimes with only one person, you know, an MLRO or maybe two or three people. And so it's important for us to remember and understand that there is a business to be run here, and that the acquisition of customers and the necessity for sales and the necessity for people to be processing large transactions in large volumes is important for us to function as a business, for the client to function as a business. So we like to talk to those people. We do like to understand whether they understand their role within a regulated organization. So do they understand why the compliance department exists, why potentially sometimes there's pushback to a customer being onboarded or a customer's transaction has been stopped in flight and they're getting kind of a bit of heat if they're a relationship manager or whoever. Mm-hmm. So it's important for us to understand, are they aware of that? And therefore, have they been through their training? Do they know how to file a SAR? And so those are really the key points. It's not a witch hunt. It's not a technical interview by any stretch of the imagination. And we'll generally talk to the first line, some of the second line, but we'll also as well talk to people who sit on the board to understand, again, what information they're getting or expecting to get on a kind of periodic basis so that they also have a decent idea of the AML framework of the firm.
Perfect, thank you. And then third question is, for smaller firms, what would you expect to see by way of a compliance monitoring plan?
Yeah, it's, I suppose there's no particularly right or wrong answer to that question. What we would expect is that there's been a framework. So for a smaller firm, a framework that has been considered. And again, I would always tell firms to go back and look at their whole firm risk assessment when they're deciding what controls need to be looked at on a priority basis. Because we're aware that I think the reason the compliance monitoring plan comes in at the highest with the highest number of findings is because it's something that people push back to further down the line. The initial thing is they want to get their AML framework set up, they want to implement controls, and they want to get going and start making money. But of course, that second line assurance comes probably after for them. But have a framework, look at your whole firm risk assessment, where we see that there's some deficiencies in our controls, where we see that there's some risks that we just need to ensure are not going to raise their heads, then we need to look at the controls around that. And generally the big ticket items that I would start with is obviously CDD. It's the basis of a good AML compliance framework. Looking at, I suppose, our transaction monitoring. So maybe looking at a number of alerts, looking at those rule sets, because especially at the start, when we're a startup, you know, we are hopefully using knowledge of the industry and potentially some sandbox data as to what rules we implement. But it's likely that those rules are going to need to be tweaked and amended quite consistently at the start. And then maybe towards the end, we can start to peel back that. But yeah, so transaction monitoring, CDD, obviously screening is a big thing. We don't want to let any sanctioned persons or entities become aboard. So making sure that our process there is strong. Those would be the ones to focus on. But I think it's about building a framework and realistically understanding who can come in and do those tasks. Because the worst thing as an auditor is to go in and see a perfectly perfectly put together compliance monitoring plan, but it's not being done. So what's realistic and how do you envision it scaling as the business scales? That's what the auditor wants to hear, is that it's been thought through.
Perfect. So we'll probably have time for one more question that has come in. So in regards to senior management sign off on high risk accounts, does this have to go through MLRO or higher, or can a designated manager approve these?
Yeah, so it can go through the designated manager, of course. I think what we would say is, as an industry standard, that the MLRO is in that position for a reason. The MLRO is in that position to be a point of escalation and an experienced person in the compliance function to oversee and sign off. And generally we would see that role as making sure if we've got our highest risk customers coming on board, the MLRO should be involved in that in some way, shape or form. And it may go above that. I think if there is a designated person to do that, they should be designated by the MLRO. And again, they should be able to escalate that further to the MLRO if necessary. So that's the way we would see it. And then, of course, there's levels even above that. But I would suggest that there should be a reason why the MLRO isn't involved. And if they're not involved, that they've at least had say in the person who is doing that, and that the MLRO still can act as a sounding board and an escalation point if necessary.
That's perfect. So we only have a few minutes left, so I think we should just wrap up the session now. So thank you very much, Richard, for that great presentation. Thank you everyone for attending the webinar. So we are going to send out the recording, and we are going to send a direct link to the report to yourselves this week in a follow-up email. Also, the recording and the report will be available on our website by the end of the week as well. And yes, I think that's all I have to update you with all. And thank you again, and thank you, Richard.
Thank you.